is constantly changing. Our guest today, David Doc Searles, argues that it's been kind of a master-slave relationship. Think of the rhetoric. Merchants capture customers. They want to own customers. At the same time, they gather data on customers, have cookies follow them around, all to ostensibly make our experience better. But is it? The great retailer John Wanamaker used to say that he knew that half of his advertising expenditure worked. He just wasn't sure which half. Given the internet and the free flow of information, shouldn't the experience be more empowering for the customer and less so for the seller? Yet as it's evolved, it's been just the opposite. Our guest, Doc Searles, wants to change that. Doc Searles is a senior editor of Linux Journal. He's co-author of the very popular Clue Train Manifesto, and he's one of the world's most widely read bloggers. Tom Friedman has called him one of the most respected technology writers in America. He's a former fellow at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University, and his latest book is The Intention Economy, When Customers Take Charge. Doc Searles, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me, Jeff. This is great.
Great to have you here. One of the key points you make is that all of this, that this whole business of retail and the internet and it being part of what we buy and the relationship between seller and customer, is that all of this is new, that it's still very, very experimental right now.
Yeah, that's true. An important thing to remember is that, you know, the marketplace, which, of course, businessmen, business people talk about all the time as this kind of holy territory in the middle of business is 10,000 years old. I mean, we've had it for a very long time. Our manners around it, the way we interact in the marketplace is very well known and it's very well understood. While the internet, which has created an entirely new part of the marketplace that's worldwide, puts everybody at zero distance from everybody else, makes all kinds of things available that weren't available before, is really now only 17 years old. It really began with the first e-commerce sites in 1995. Amazon and eBay were born then. The graphical browser came along then. The first ISPs came along then. We got email as we know it today that same year. So we can date pretty clearly when the internet that we know started. It had earlier beginnings, but it's only 17 years old. It's not even old enough to drink yet. And, and we're just trying to figure, you know, we're actually, you know, as popular as things like, as services like Google and Facebook and Twitter and eBay and all of e-commerce are, they're still just experimental. It's still very new. And if you're getting older, like I am, and you've been around a long time, you've seen a lot of things come and go, it's actually a lot clearer than when you've grown up, say, with, you know, if Facebook started in high school for you, it seems like it's a permanent thing, but it's not. It's actually just experimental. And that's one reason why we haven't worked out the manners yet. The advertising side of the business, online advertising, which actually isn't really advertising, it's a kind of direct marketing or direct mail, or direct response, they call it in the business. It takes advantage of us. They do it because they can, because we haven't worked out the tech yet. But we're starting to find ways that customers are taking power into their own hands. For example, with ad blocking and tracking blocking browser extensions. In the Wall Street Journal article I just wrote, there's a company called Clarity Ray, which has done a lot of research on this. Of course, they have a vested interest in it, but nonetheless, it's the only research I've seen. That shows as much as 22% of users in some places, like Austria, block ads and block tracking and are smart enough to do that. It's not a hard thing to do. They're the most popular browser extensions is blocking software. So there is some tide turning. But that's only the beginning. I mean, basically, we've been working on, we being the project I've been working on and others as well, have been working on ways that many other ways that customers or ordinary citizens can take more control over their data, more control over the way they relate to companies, more control over the way that they interact in the marketplace, which actually has much more promise for the marketplace than trying to improve advertising endlessly.
Mm-hmm. One of the ironies in all of this is that all of this change has created for many people the illusion, at least, that they're in charge of their online life, and in fact, the opposite is true.
Absolutely. Think about it. I mean, if you're operating online at all, you have dozens, maybe even hundreds of logins and passwords, mm-hmm. all of them, Well, of course, they're not really different. We'll use the same one for many different ones because we can't remember them all. But the thing is that who we are and how we work is divided up between all these different places. In the technology business, we call these silos or walled gardens. So while the Internet appears to be a single, coherent place, who we are on the Internet really is only who we are in relationship to all these different places, and all of them are different. And that really makes it very inconvenient for us. So if we, for example, want to change our address once for all these guys, we can't. We have to go separately from one to the other, like a bee from flower to flower to flower. That's not being very empowered. And we have no independent power unless, say, we have our own website and our own web service and our own company, but then we're operating a silo of our own as well. So the siloed system, which is actually something that was born so only 17 years ago with the Internet called client-server, is derisively referred to within the industry to some degree as calf-cow or as slave-master. That's part of the web architecture that's really not native to the value system of the Internet as it was designed in the first place, which is one where there's actually a kind of equal footing for everybody. We don't have that. You know, we're very subordinate when we're at Amazon or we're at eBay. As good as those places are, we're sort of in their territory when we're there and don't have much power other than what they give us.
But the way it's been turned back on us with this idea of data collection and big data, as you talk about, is that somehow all of this information, that most of which we give up voluntarily, all of the information that's gathered on us is somehow going to empower us to have more choice.
Yeah, it's not. That's a huge illusion. But the full story on this, and it hasn't been told yet, I'm trying to figure it out, but we could trace the term big data. We've had big data for a long time. We've had big data as long as we've had data. Back in the 60s and 70s, you know, corporate computing was called data processing. And we've been coughing up big data all over the place for the duration. But the term big data got hot like about a year and a half ago. There was a big study published by McKinsey and IBM and Oracle and a lot of other big companies are suddenly selling big data. And there's a lot that's good about big data, you know, for studying DNA, for pharmaceuticals, for military uses, there's a lot of really good scientific and mathematical and academic purposes for large quantities of data and crunching that and understanding it. But for understanding us, it's completely oxymoronic. If you read the literature of IBM and some of these other companies and what's being said by the advertising industry, by the online advertising industry about big data, there's this illusion that they can know the customer better than the customer knows themselves. I was reading a piece a couple of days ago by somebody writing in the banking industry about how the way, because banks are shutting branches and because they're firing tellers and other human beings that can interact directly with customers, they actually, without irony, are saying, oh, but we can find better ways to understand our customers through big data by studying them and following them around. It's completely insane. And it only appears to be sane within its own ecosystem. But that ecosystem, and by echo I mean like a sound reverberating back to you, within that ecosystem, that echo chamber, I guess is a better way of putting it. Mm-hmm. Within that echo chamber, there's nobody, or very few people other than me and the people I work with, who are saying, wait a minute, this is nuts. This is based, actually, with Eli Pariser, that's P-A-R-I-S-E-R.
Right.
Highly recommend a book he had, came out a year ago, called The Filter Bubble. And he has in it a little section called A Bad Theory of You. And it's about how the idea behind this big data is that they can actually understand you perfectly. This you know, came up with a philosopher and a mathematician in France named Laplace in the late 18th century that was disproven later. I mean, the notion that predestination is a certainty because science could now know where everything is, and if you had perfect knowledge of all particles moving, you could predict everything until the end of time. A century later, quantum mechanics came along and said, you know what, the universe is not determined. It's very indeterminate at a base level. And on top of that, nothing could be more human than the differences between all of us. What makes us unique as human beings is that no two one of us are alike. We cannot be predicted. And these guys actually think they can and are spending a huge amount of money on doing that. And what this masks is that what's really going on is that individuals inside companies are getting more empowered. They're saying, you know what, we don't want BlackBerries. We don't want, you know, a lockdown Windows computer on our desk. We've got our iPad here. We've got our iPhones. We've got our Androids. We're on our own now. And, you know, we want to be independent as well as the customers being independent. And that's really threatening to big business right now.
Right. And even in big business in the technology world, it's silly to think that companies like Facebook or Google or Amazon or even the banks you talked about before are really going to be in the business of giving customers more independence.
Well, here's the interesting thing about Facebook and not Amazon, but Google, which is that you're not a customer of them. You're a consumer. And there's an important distinction between the two. A consumer only consumes. My friend Jerry Mikulski, who's there in the Bay Area, calls this, you know, being a gullet with wallets. He calls consumers gullets with wallets and eyeballs. And when you look at people as consumers and not as customers, you feel you can take advantage of them, or that they're just kind of like this plankton, you know, that's at the bottom level of the food chain, whereas customers are actually paying you money. Google doesn't want people paying them money, and nor does Facebook, because you're the product as the consumer being sold to their real customers, who are the advertisers. And that is going to hurt them in the long run, that they have no financial accountability to their users. They're just users. Only the computer industry and the drug industry uses that term, by the way, users. On the other hand, Amazon actually does have a real relationship with you as a customer, and I think that is to their advantage to a huge degree. But a measure of how early it is in that system is that Amazon has, in fact, become a kind of a monopoly. They own like 25% of all e-commerce right now. They're a monopoly in the book business and probably some other businesses as well. I don't think this is healthy either, but that's also because they operate the biggest silo. And the way we have constructed business online is it's silo versus silo. And I think that's a problem as well that only customers and employees operating as individuals can solve in the long run.
And talk about how the projects that you've been working on, specifically VRM, Vendor Relationship Management, how is that seeking to change this dynamic?
The simple way of looking at it is that we're simply giving individuals, customers, tools that make them both independent of sellers, but better able to engage with them. Think of this as the equivalent of giving you a car or giving you the pieces to make a car with. A car is a VRM tool. It gives you independence and a better way to engage. We have parking lots now, we have highways, but we have a sense when we're in a car that's us. That's our space. You can't get in this space. You can't be followed in here. We don't want to be tracked when we're in our car. It would creep us out. But a car is a VRM tool. It's got a trunk. You've got ways of relating to business in the way a car is designed and the way infrastructure is designed around it. It's very early in this. We've got about 50 projects. Some of them are commercial projects. Some of them are open source, listed at the wiki for Project VRM, which is at the Berkman Center at Harvard. And if you just look up VRM, you'll find it. Most of these are small. Most of these are companies doing things like what are called personal data stores or lockers, and building applications on top of those. There's a company called Singly, S-I-N-G-L-Y, down the road there in San Francisco. There's one in D.C. called Personal. There are others in the U.K. Called The Customer's Voice and MyDex. There's one in South Africa called Trust Fabric. These are ones that are working on ways for you to gather and put to use the data that is yours, whether it's healthcare data or fitness data or other things like that. Data that primarily has use value, not sale value. You'll read some things about, well, you can sell your data and get in on this marketing thing. I think that's a non-starter. I think that the big advantage is I know what my fitness data is. I should be a better insurance risk, you know, or something like that. There are lots of ways that we can put that to use. That's just one category. There are others that have to do with what we call intent casting. Intent casting is saying, you know, I need a stroller for twins in downtown Napa in the next 2 hours. I've got $200. Who's coming through? Without having to go to Amazon or to Craigslist or to go to one of these silos, just to be able to broadcast that to the marketplace as an intention to buy, but without revealing personal data or what they call PII, personally identifiable data,
mm-hmm.
get back legitimate offers. But to do that on your terms, saying, for example, you know what, once we do business, I don't want to get any marketing materials from you. Or if I already have a relationship with you, like let's say I have a relationship with Toys R Us, well, you get first dibs at my business. But basically, those are two ways I've mentioned so far, there are others as well, that VRM tools put the customer in charge.
And all of those things work when we know what it is we want. If we know we want that stroller of a certain kind or a certain color in a certain place, what about the other side of the argument that in many cases we don't know what we want?
Well, I think a lot of the time we don't know exactly what we want. And so there's a, you know, there's intention there as well. I mean, and this is why Google has been so successful with search. I mean, we are expressing an intent when we're searching for something. Where the problem comes in is that we need to be able to signal when we're making a commercial inquiry and when we're not. Most of the time we're not. You know, most of the time, if we want to know the height of Mount Everest, we're probably not doing that because we're shopping for climbing gear. And the way that Google is built as a business assumes that we're making a commercial, we're expressing commercial intent all the time. Same to some degree with Facebook and others in the advertising business. We're going to figure this out. I think part of what's going to happen with VRM tools is that we'll have more ways of saying, here's generally what I'm doing now. Here's generally what I'm interested in. If you want to help me figure out what I want, good. Here's the middle ground where we can meet. Rather than where you're, you know, that John Wanamaker reference at the beginning. That's so typical of the advertising business. Several things are true here. First of all, John Wanamaker didn't say it. He just wrote it down, and they found it after he was dead. The second thing is, and I've really dug into this, it's really hard to find the facts on the matter. And the other thing is a number of people had already said that. And the most important thing is it's not true. Nobody knows that half their advertising works. Half their advertising works is a huge number. It's 99.xx% of advertising doesn't work
right.
Most of the time. It works out economically because you're sending a broad thing that in economics they call a signal, which is saying, you know, we're Pepsi, we sell soft drinks, you're gonna find them in the store. Even if you don't buy it, you know we're a serious company. That's the main thing that advertising does. What this direct response advertising that Google does and what most of what we see online attempts to do is sell you something right now. It doesn't have the rest of that thing called a signal that says we're sufficient. It says we're personalizing this for you. And right now, that's becoming absurd. It's I don't know how many times, all really bad guesses of what we're looking for and really bad tracking even. You know, the reason tracking isn't scary is because, so far, is because it's really bad. You know, I visit a game store for my, or let's put it this way, Thomas the Tank Engine for my grandson, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to hear that Thomas the Tank Engine for the rest of time, and every time I go from one site to another. But I get that. I'll get Thomas the Tank Engine everywhere I go because it thinks I'm a five-year-old. And, you know, bad assumptions are being made. That and it goes on in the grocery store, too. You know, you got your loyalty card, you check out, you just bought some soup, and then you'll see on the back of the receipt, oh, here's a discount on a thing you just bought. That's big data working for me. That's advertising at its best. It's not. What we need really is something that's much more collaborative, much more interactive, where we can, you know, if we're going to have a relationship with a store, they should be looking in that, you know, if you're interested, I'll tell you why I'm buying this bread and not that bread. But for the most part, I don't want you even caring about it. You know, I'll watch how much sales stock goes down if you like. But if you want to know more from me, let's have a real relationship where I can tell you, and I go into this in my book, for example, you know, I love La Brea bread from Los Angeles. I love Cholula hot sauce. You can get big bottles in California. You can't get big bottles in Massachusetts, which is where I am now. I'd like a big bottle of that. You know, well, if I buy that at a store, they say, oh, you like the little bottles, because that's all they sell. They don't know that I want the big bottles. And you don't know that because we're not really interacting. They're just seeing something I do and making some bad guesses about it. That's not, we need a system in which there's real interactivity going on that's not burdening either side with either the need to do guesswork or the need to pay labor than is actually required. And that's fallow ground. We don't know how that's all going to sort out yet, but it will over time.
And how much of it continues on because the barriers to entry are so low, because it is so cheap to do these things?
Well, I think it's going to go on until it obviously fails. You know, right now the percentages are good enough for Google and for Facebook. Where the real danger is, and this is where VRM really is a threat to them, and it should be, because I'd love to see them interested in it, but they're not yet. I know people at both companies, but it's not yet. You can't have success generally inside a big company. Is that it works well enough? You know, if you only have a 0.0% click through rate on an ad, and it pays for itself, well, who's lost? It's not a bad thing. But what happens when we can intent cast a lot more effectively, when we do start working around the Googles and Facebooks and the advertising mills of the world to come up with better ways of interacting with stores than we have now, say, with loyalty cards, which are just the offline equivalent of the login and the password? What happens when we start doing that? And the market becomes more efficient because customers and sellers are interacting in a genuine way and not a coercive way. Well, that's going to obsolete a lot of advertising as we know it, because it'll be exposed for the guesswork it is. And the fact that Google makes 97% or whatever it is of their money from advertising, and Facebook, I think, makes 90%, is a real risk for them. And they're going to have to find a different way to do business, probably by embracing VRM stuff, and that's what I'm hoping for.
Mm-hmm. How does VRM get embraced within the context of those existing situations like Google or Facebook, for example?
Well, I think there are several ways. One is that there are industries, for example, banking right now, that are looking at VRM and just looking at the marketplace. We don't need to look at just our work with VRM. If you just look at the marketplace and say, you know what, we're not a job, banking especially. It's gone so far away from its original mission of giving people a way to save and borrow money and making a profit off of the arbitrage in the middle of that. Well, because they've just basically become investment places. Well, you know, they're looking at VRM and saying, how can we work with this stuff? How can we become, for example, I was talking to a guy with J.P. Morgan Chase a couple of weeks ago about this. He gave the example of the stroller for twins, for example, in this case in Central Park. If you have a relationship with the bank and you're willing to escrow the money, say, my $200 is actually good. It's sitting over here at J.P. Morgan Chase. You can pick it up when we're ready. And by the way, J.P. Morgan Chase has relationships with these delivery services and these stores, and they'll get favored treatment, or they'll help shorten the distance between your intent and the fulfilling of it. Well, that's a business that the banks can be in. And we call that Emancipay, by the way. That's another VRM initiative. And we've been talking and actually working with a division of SWIFT, the International Banking Organization, called InnoTribe, which is their innovation wing that incubates new projects, research projects. A number of VRM developers have been working with them over the last year and a half on coming up with new businesses for banks around that. There are other people working in retail, and other businesses where there are people within those businesses that are seeing the writing on the wall and taking advantage of it. And in CRM, which is the reciprocal of VRM, the customer relationship management, the people who run call centers, for example, and helping salespeople, the VRM and saying, well, geez, we really need to do a better job here. How can customers help us help them?
does this have the danger of accentuating what you were talking about earlier, what Eli Pariser talks about in terms of the filter bubble? Does this make our scope in some ways narrower in terms of looking only for the things that we think we want and not giving us as much opportunity to explore?
I think it actually gives us more opportunity to explore by kind of partitioning the stuff we're intentional about right now from the stuff we more generally care about. Right now, what we have is the sell side trying to be narrow, trying to say, oh, you like Thomas the Tank Engine, we're going to give you nothing but Thomas the Tank Engine, or shoes, or whatever else it might be. The interesting thing about the way that we go about the world, the brick-and-mortar marketplace and the online marketplace, is that we're not shopping most of the time. Most of the time, our interests are of a specific sort, but in a general way. You know, I want to know the time of Japan. I want to know, what these shipping companies are. I want to know something for school. I'm just looking this on a map. The district in Manhattan where a friend lives, is it Murray Hill or is it Midtown? So we go on our iPad and we look that up and see, oh, that's actually Murray Hill. Good. Well, I wasn't interested in selling anything there or buying anything there at all. And that's the general side of things. And we've lost, on the sell side, we've lost track of that because the commercial web assumes you're buying something all the time. The only significant part of the non-commercial web right now is Wikipedia. And Wikipedia is interesting because it's like the only thing that's not commercial that tends to rise to the top of search results. That's a dysfunction. We need more things that are of a general interest rather than a specific commercial interest when we're searching around on the web. I think that's a temporary problem, but it's one that we need to solve.
So that this intention economy becomes hopefully the end state of all of this.
Yeah, that's what I see happening. Right now we have what I call, and others do too, an attention economy, one that's focused on the sell side of grabbing people's attention and trying to sell them something. Once intentionality becomes more of the direction that's really obvious in what an individual is doing, the system will sort itself out. So, for example, if you're standing on a street, in Napa, and you see somebody walking along, you don't assume much about what they're doing, right? I mean, if they go into a store, you assume they're interested in that store. But for the most part, if they're sitting outside having a cup of coffee or just talking to somebody else, we grant them the space to have the intentions that they are obviously manifesting in what they're doing. We don't have that on the web yet. That is still a big empty space that's being filled very poorly by companies that are guessing that we're always being commercial in our intent and therefore fair game for guesswork about us. And I think that's, again, a temporary thing, but it's so normal right now that we're taking it for granted, but it's a good idea to look past it.
And what role, if any, is there for advertising or marketing within the context of the intention economy?
I think there are two things. For advertising first, I think advertising, online advertising, needs to look back at what worked in traditional advertising for 150 years, which we think brand advertising, but it's more than that. It's doing the Olympics because we know that that's a way that we get our name and we make ourselves familiar to a lot of people. That's been lost in online advertising in part because it's not really advertising. It's something else that looks like advertising. It's called advertising. But I think that there's a lot that new field can learn from the old one. For marketing, there's a real tough challenge that in traditional companies, there was always somebody called a VP of sales and marketing. And always seemed to be the salesperson who was running it. There's never a marketing person on top of that. And that was because sales touched the customer and marketing politically inside a company couldn't do that. So it had to be strategic and not touch the customer. Well, now marketing is trying to touch the customer, but through big data. That's a mistake. I think that what marketing needs to do, and there are lots of marketing trying to do this, is help sales and help the company in general get real with customers and let customers take the lead. need. I think the best thing that you can do right now is look at what the VRM product is doing and embrace them and advocate them inside the company.
Doc Searles, his book is The Intention Economy, When Customers Take Charge. Doc, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
I really appreciate it. Thank you, too.